be so strict that their children leave the church, and I might add another dimension to that, that they leave home. If it were not possible to do this, I don't believe we'd have the language we have in Ephesians 6, verse 4, or in Colossians 3:21. Fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath. And in Colossians 3:21, fathers, do not provoke your children lest they become discouraged. The word provoke, I think, is significant here. It means to cause frustration or anger by argument, taunting, excessive teasing, or physical restraint. There are a great many things that can cause children to be unhappy with their parents. And I'm going to mention as many things as I can in the time that permits. Now, what we would like, of course, is for our children to receive our saying, Proverbs 4:10. We would like them to know that when you're taught and when the father is heeded and the mother is happy, that you keep the commands and live. Proverbs 4:3, verse 4. We'd like it known that a wise son makes a glad father. And there are many complimentary things that can be said when children are happy, when they're satisfied, and when all is going well in the family. Come, let us reason together. Parents sometimes exaggerate or misrepresent activities or behaviors in an effort to protect their children from evil influences. I have often heard such exaggerations, been guilty of it myself a few times. Children deserve honesty. Honesty. We should not make something sound worse than it is in an effort to convince them they shouldn't do that. For example, as the world sees it, sin is fun. And it may seem the same to children. We realize, of course, that Satan sugarcoats everything. He never represents it as it is, but always makes it look very enticing. And if we can explain to our children what consequences are, and I think we'll have to demonstrate that, especially to younger children, because consequences typically are not understood. We're not to explain this hypothetically, but literally. In other words, pick out situations in a child's life. For example, ask him, what happened when you went too fast on your bicycle? Pick a literal example where the consequences were rather painful. Or, what happened when you slammed that front door? Let him remember that the glass broke. Let him remember that he was severely reprimanded. In other words, consequences that he can associate with and remember. Nothing that he must imagine, but something in his own experience. Now, sometimes parents refuse to obey the prohibitions and the taboos that they set for their children. I believe that children deserve explanations to the very best of our ability, and that if we prohibit them from doing something, we should tell them why, even though it might be rather difficult. And I might say this, that if children discover that their parents have given them wrong information, or if parents are loath to give information, they will get the information. They'll get it from their peers or from someone that you perhaps would rather they didn't get it from. But they will get the information. And the sad consequence of that is that parents lose the trust of their children. Unusual strictness in the part of parents is often accompanied by frequent explanations, or children would call these lectures, pertaining to the behavior of their children. I've believed all my life that children don't need to be overtold. They heard you. They know what you said. They simply don't intend to do it. They're not deaf, believe me. Now, parents who deeply care for their children and express this love both orally and physically are far more likely to have children who have liberal doses of self-esteem. We talk a great deal about the lack of self-esteem. We talk about poor self-concepts. We talk about children who don't have any self-value or any self-worth. And the consequences of that sometimes are very serious. If we treat our children as excess baggage, we can't expect them to think they are valuable or important. And sometimes children are treated as excess baggage when we simply don't seem to have time for them, or we just don't seem to include them as high priorities around the house. If a parent has no real affection, no real interest in what a child is doing, then you can understand why they sometimes feel rather estranged. Do you believe that love can strangle as well as enhance the life of a child? Let me give you a literal example that I experienced when I was 18 years of age. This was a young man that I met in the Naval Enlistment Office in St. Louis, Missouri, when it became evident that we were going to have to select some branch of the service. I preferred the Navy to the Army, so went there to enlist. And this is when I met this boy, 6'3", weighed about 200 pounds, very laid back, rather shy, very mild-natured. I also met another fellow there who was about the same size, boisterous, belligerent, and very pushy. There were 45 of us who left on the troop train to go to San Diego, California, to go to the boot camp there, and in the process, of course, we all got fairly well acquainted. And one of these boys, the one that was rather loud and boisterous, his name was Slim, took it upon himself to abuse this particular boy because he wasn't of that nature at all. And as I talked to this boy who was being abused, I would say that he was still tied to his mother's apron strings. He had never been allowed to make any decisions to speak of for himself. She had made them all for him. I'd say that she had done most of his thinking for him through the years. And consequently, he just wasn't able to cope with a situation like this. He didn't know what to do with it. But one day, the boy was lying down on the seats. We didn't have any Pullman service in these coaches, but you could lay two seats down and kind of sleep across. He was lying there, and Slim slips a book of matches into the welt of his shoe and sets it on fire. Well, if you've ever had a hot foot, you know what this feels like. And the boy, of course, came up in some consternation. Slim wanted him to make some kind of an offensive move so that he didn't have an excuse to attack him. But, of course, the boy didn't know what to do. He'd never had a fight in his life. He'd been very, very sheltered. Well, some of us had all we could stand of Slim, so we just sort of gathered around and put him in his place so that he wouldn't bother this boy anymore. But I had contact with this boy in boot camp, and he was just as lost, just as unable to cope with the life there as he was on the train. And he didn't make it in service. He was discharged as unfit for service. Not dishonorably, just unfit for service. And the sole reason was that he just simply had never been allowed to grow up naturally and normally, or he'd have been able to cope, I believe, much better than he did. When people are unsure like this, because they've been over-sheltered, sometimes they get into worse trouble, perhaps, than if they had been over-informed. If we don't teach our children to cope with this world, I think we're doing them a great disservice. I have seen in my lifetime some congregational attitudes, very stern, very unrelenting, and also very unforgiving. The spirit of the church has changed through the years for the better. I don't know who first verbalized this, but there was a time when it was thought that the more stern we could be, the better things would go. Some of you are old enough to remember that. And we were very hard on people sometimes. And churches extremely strict, very forbidding, where children were concerned. And I know of three cases in particular where children left the church for that very reason. There simply was no understanding at all of their problems, even their personalities, by the congregation. And there was nothing but disapproval. Instead of encouragement, they got a scowl here and a frown there. And enough of this was enough, and they left. So it isn't only in the family at home. This happens also in the family of God. And when I say we've grown a great deal since that time, I think that's very much to our good, because I think we are much more likely to encourage now than to discourage. Let me give you another example, which was one of the saddest things I think I've seen in a long time. I was in another state, so you won't know this family. But I was invited to have the evening meal with these folks. I arrived a little bit early, and two lovely children in the house, one about 5 and the other about 2. And the little boy who was 2 came and climbed up on my lap, very friendly. And the little girl came and sat beside me, so I started reading to them and talking to them. Delightful kids, they really were, just lovely children. And this went on for 15 or 20 minutes. And the mother of the family came into the room, and we had quite a conversation. And then Dad came home. The moment the door opened, the children scattered. They went to their bedrooms. And the mother went to the kitchen, and not another sound did she make. So when the meal was served, probably about 10 minutes later, when we came to the table, one child was there and the other was just a moment late. They were required to wash their hands, comb their hair, and straighten up their clothing before they came to the table. There's nothing wrong with that. But when she came to the table about a minute late, Father glared at her and said, "You're late, so you can sit there and watch us eat." Now, this little girl was about 7. And I just cried inside for that child. She didn't make a sound, didn't say anything at all. She just kind of ducked her head and sat there. And I'm sure this wasn't the first time that had happened. The only conversation during the meal was between the father and myself. The mother said nothing. Neither child made a sound. And it was obvious to me that those children were deathly afraid of their father, just as plain as day, and so was his wife. He ruled in that household by fear. I would call this man a tyrant. And everything in me reacted negatively to that situation. And so after the meal was over, I told the man very frankly what I thought of something, and he didn't like it. He didn't like it so much that I've never been back to that congregation. That's been quite a few years ago. But I told him that he was running a grave risk of losing his children just as soon as they could leave that house. And I don't think I was wrong, because when you put children in such an oppressive atmosphere and they get an opportunity to get away from it, they're gone. And I also told him that because of the way you're treating people, you may be one of those persons in old age who is all alone and nobody wants to see you. I just told him that very frankly. And of course he couldn't take it, and we just leave it there. I haven't been in many houses like that, thank the Lord. But that will that'll really get to you, or at least it really got to me. I still commiserate with those children and that mother. Every time I think about it, it upsets me a little bit. So I know what disapproval does. Disapproval with some people makes them very bitter. Disapproval with some causes them almost to withdraw from society. It works on the mind. And I've hardly ever seen a person who, under constant disapproval, continues to react normally for very long. Because that's a kind of pressure that people simply can't stand for very long. Something's going to happen. Something's going to give. And I think this is why we were told in Ephesians 4, verse 32, that we should treat one another with kindness, with tenderheartedness, and be very quick to forgive. Because God knows that we can't live under a load of disapproval. He understands that we have to have relief from that. And I think that also is why we're told in Romans 14, verse 1, that if we have a weak member, we don't receive them in order to condemn them, to argue with them, to put them down. We simply do not treat people that way. Even adults cannot handle that successfully, much less children. Sometimes lack of understanding of a situation causes people to be unbending and unnecessarily harsh. And there are many, many times I have noticed when children in particular, around the ages of 13 and 14, are very reluctant to explain things thoroughly. I suppose every generation feels that it can't really communicate adequately with the one before it. I mean, this is not a phenomenon that is not common, I think, to the world, that we have trouble getting our children to fully discuss things with us. They'll tell us a little bit. I used to ask my son when he came home from school, "How was school?" "Fine." "Anything happen?" "Nope." And that was that. I suspect that's an experience many of you have had. And if you depended on them to inform you how things were going, you would just simply never know. So if you don't have a friend at school or a confidant somewhere in the community who does, you have no idea what's going on or what's happening. And so children frequently don't tell you when they're hurting. They really and truly don't, especially if they think you might not be understanding or receptive. If you are a rather stern, forbidding parent, a child dreads the fire. They don't like disapproval, and they fear that if they confide in you, they're going to get a hiding out instead of a hug and a kiss. And that's why they don't confide many times in older people. That lack of understanding, of course, can be extremely serious. Now, I have talked to parents who feel that their children are not capable, by reason of age or maturity, to make their own decisions. And to some extent, that is true, in early age especially. But there are some decisions that young children can make and should be encouraged to make. In other words, we should teach our children to make decisions and insist that they do, so that they won't be reluctant to do this. When my father, my brother, and I went shopping, my father invariably would get frustrated and angry. For some reason, my brother couldn't make a decision. And Dad would ask him, "You like this?" "I don't know." "You like that?" "I don't know." And pretty soon, Dad was upset. Because "I don't know" doesn't pick out this pair or that pair. So sometimes these things are very close to home. We should make sure that our children make all the decisions they're capable of making. And I mean by that, we want them to become accustomed to thinking and considering and making choices. And we should put such opportunities before them. You can present them with food choices, present them with some clothing choices, let them make the decision. You can present them with some choices of tasks or jobs around the house. Which would you rather do if the difficulty of each is about the same? Which would you rather do? Let them make a choice. Let them learn to make decisions. Sometimes, whether we will take a little side trip or not, or where we eat, or things of this kind, sometimes we should let our children decide. It isn't going to cost us anything, even if it isn't our favorite place. Let them learn to make decisions. You see, children who are accustomed to making decisions and thinking things through are not nearly so likely to be deceived, either by their counterparts, by older people, or when they get a little older, by things that are false and wrong. They're just simply not as easy to trick. They're just not as easy to deceive. Children who are naive and just not unworldly at all in their thinking, because their decisions have been made for them about too many things, are easy prey. They truly are. If they're not used to thinking things through and making choices, they're easy prey for Satan and his cohorts. And if you find the young people who are most vulnerable, they will almost always be those who are rather naive. The kids who are pretty sharp about these things typically are not deceived and typically do not go for wrong things as readily. In our society today, there is one area in particular where we should inform our children. Homosexual men love to find a young boy of 12 to 14 years of age that they can influence. And they will do this at every opportunity. The butches, as they are called, believe that is the most noble and manly way of comporting themselves, and they believe it is a very fine thing for the young men. Naivety is dangerous with our children. We have to be very, very careful. Now, if you make too many decisions for your children and don't teach them to make their own, I wonder how well they'll contend for the faith. If we don't have some self-confidence, if we don't believe in ourselves to a considerable degree, we don't have the boldness nor the backbone to contend for the faith as we should. And a lot of this is because of how we're reared, how we're brought up. I believe that things we are told are not as important to us most of the times as the things we have learned through give and take, argument, and discussion. And some parents do a lot of telling, but almost no discussing with their children. Because the parents seem to feel the give and take, they feel inadequate somehow to have an open forum discussion with their children. Because the children may not like something they've done, and the parent is immature and unable to cope with that. So they just tell, but that's as far as they go with their children. Have you ever thought about why the so-called prodigal son left home? Ever wondered about that? Why would a younger son become dissatisfied? Well, there are a great many possible reasons. The older son, of course, receives a double portion. He's the one who will inherit. That puts the younger sons in a rather untenable position. Perhaps he resented that. Perhaps the father wasn't paying a lot of attention to him. Perhaps he felt just a little bit like a stranger in the family. Perhaps the father had been very strict with him. Possibly the father administered punishment that the child thought was unfair. We don't know the reason, but we do know that he was anxious to get away from home. So he must have had some cause, something that stuck in his craw, something he didn't like, or he wouldn't have been so anxious to leave. But you notice when the father gave him his share, he didn't tarry. He left. And I think it would be fair to the story to say that when he left, he wasn't planning on returning. I don't think that was part of his thinking, because not until things became very desperate did that thought come. So he obviously meant to break things off with his father and family and not come back. And those things happen in families. Sometimes a child announces, "I'm leaving. I'm going to set up my own residence. I don't want to live here anymore." And sometimes they're not very specific as to why, because again, they're not sure how what they say will be received or understood. Make opportunities to be alone with your children. Take them on a short trip. Take them out to eat. Take them to the store with you. But make opportunities to be alone with one child at a time. And talk to that child about all kinds of things. Level with them. And sound them out. I think this is critically important. Because when you have a one-on-one relationship away from the house, sometimes away from some feelings that they associate with home, and get them into a neutral situation where just the two of you are interacting, sometimes they really open up. Both of my kids would do that. Much better one-on-one in a neutral situation than they would at home. So I frequently took advantage of that, and it was very, very profitable. I would suggest that you do the same, because it just simply creates more understanding and better attitudes between child and parent. Now, when you set rules that must be observed, make sure children know where you'll bend and where you won't. Because in some areas you should be inflexible, but in others you should bend. It is the consistent inflexibility which causes the problems. If you will bend in some areas, and you can, then they'll give you the right to be inflexible in some. Children, I think, are basically fair-minded if we give them every opportunity. Now, I have a whole list of things I would like to tell you, but time doesn't permit. So let me summarize what I would have said. Don't ever do or say anything that embarrasses your children in public. I have seen kids just die inside from criticism of their parents in public to other people. Even adults can't stand this. What if a wife says to a woman she knows, "Oh, my husband never does anything right," and he's standing there? That doesn't go over either. And believe me, it doesn't go with children. So if you can, you have to respect them, let them save face. You have to respect what they think other people think of them. There are so many things involved here, so many things we can talk about. But I think the ultimate tragedy of life would be that the very love and concern that we lavish on our children, if misdirected, can be their undoing.